All right. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:17 p.m. on Monday, April 11th. Members present here in Barnes' room are Representatives Coffin, Cardi, Snyder, and myself, Chair Sponholz. We are joined by Representative Schrage on Teams, and with that, we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks so much to our Secretary, Leah Frazier, who's participating remotely, and our LIO moderator, Lydia Klein. Reminder to members to announce yourself before speaking for those listening online. If you haven't already, it's a great time to silence your cell phones. We have three items on our agenda today. The first one is an introductory hearing for Senate Bill 176 by Senator Wilson around natural health hairstyles, which is a companion legislation to legislation we heard last week, introducing a committee substitute for House Bill 176, direct health care agreements that are not insurance, and then introducing a committee substitute for House Bill 276, psychologists. With that, we're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 174. So if Senator Wilson and your staff can proceed to the dais and introduce the legislation in summary.
Thank you. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson from Senate District D, and with me is my staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and committee members today for hearing this bill, Senate Bill 174. Since the committee already heard the companion, HB 312, this will just be a short reintroduction. And we just want to thank the representative from District 19 who's behind me who did a great job on this piece of legislation. Senate Bill 174 prohibits schools, workplace from enacting a dress code that restricts someone from wearing their natural hair. This bill addresses an issue that most people deal and endure in silence. No employee or student should be prohibited from participating in a workplace or school or attending school just because they're wearing the natural hair. People choose to wear the natural hair for many reasons, including cultural connectiveness, protective of the hairstyle, texture, and growth, or simply their present. Whatever the reason, hairstyle has no correlation to the workplace or performance. One study has shown that people of color have to change their hair from its natural state just to fit in the office. Another study published in the Social Psychological and Personality Science Journal last year confirmed a truth that many folks of color have long suspected and grappling with today, and that is in job recruitment, natural hairstyle puts them at a disadvantage for getting interviewed and subsequently hired. For both the workplace and schools, we just want to make sure and clarify this does not apply to health or safety rules, regulations, or ordinance. For example, hair nets still need to be worn in food services. You don't want someone with long hair and dreads to be working a wood chipper, wood shop, or for welding purposes, so that still for safety and another safety and regulation ordinances, that bill does not apply for that if it causes a danger to that to themselves or others. Again, Senate Bill 174 defines what standards are acceptable in school districts, employers to place on hair, and helps end hair discrimination. I just want to say thank you for this time, and there was a slight difference in the this version of the bill than what the bill and this House companion, and I believe Ms. Martin can briefly cover those two sections of lines.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. As Senator Wilson noted, there's just two really small changes. Section 1 and in 2 of the bill are basically identical to each other. One deals with the school student relationship, and one deals with the employer-employee relationship. And so page 1, line 7, and then page 2, line 5, this including wearing head wraps is not included in the House version. And then page 1, line 10, and page 2, line 8, afros, cornrows, and bantu knots are not included in the original legislation, or the House version of the legislation. And those were included in a Senate committee. This list is not exhaustive of all the natural hairstyles that are out there, but they just thought that it was important to include a couple more to have some more examples in there. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, do we have any questions for either Senator Wilson or his staff? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. I'm curious, on page 1, line 11, item 3, requires a student to permanently or semi-permanently alter the student's natural hair. Just curious what had occurred to cause that that requirement to be in the bill.
So this, for example, through the chair, Senator David Wilson, that would require someone, let's say if they were competing into, this happened nationally, competing in the wrestling tournament, a young gentleman had to cut his hair in order to participate in that school function. And so this is one of those things saying that the government body of a school cannot say you have to alter your hair to do that. Other places of work and employment may say you can't wear kink hair, you may have to straighten your hair. And so to do that, you have to put a chemical relaxer into your head, and if you leave it on too long, it burns, and it becomes very uncomfortable. One of the other important things to consider in this piece of legislation, I urge members to call around to local hairdressers or barbershops and see if they work on type 4C hair. The answer for many places is no, and good luck finding someone to work on 4C hair in places where folks of color make up less than 5% of the population.
You follow?
Could you explain that designation? I'm unfamiliar with it.
Yes, through the chair. Type 4C hair is basically a really hard, more of a coarse texture of hair, and many hairdressers just don't have enough practice, and so they just choose not to work on that style of hair. And so it's just a style type that hairdressers are trained to work upon.
All right, thank you. And I want to recognize that Representative Nelson joined us at 3:18 p.m. Are there any additional questions for Senator Wilson? Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, you made mention that page 1, line 7, including the wearing head wraps, was not in the House bill but included in the Senate bill. What was the reason for including headdress type things, and what was the problem that you were hearing to include that?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, this happened in the Senate Education Committee. The Senate Education Committee felt that was something that they would like to have added as protective hair wraps, like a silk scarf, for example, will help maintain and keep hair. It's sort of complicated to explain, but that's one of those additional items in certain head wraps will just keep hair more in a better maintained, neat appearance. And so they felt that was something that was more culturally relevant. It's, I think that's the best way to, and maybe Ms. Martin might want to explain that on a different
level. Ms. Martin, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So this isn't necessarily head wraps that are associated with religion or anything like that. That's already protected in different parts of statute. There was worry that head wraps that protect the texture of the hair to from environmental damage just by, you know, including a silk head wrap was not underneath this legislation. And so they wanted to include that. It was a little ambiguous whether what that was in there.
Can you follow up?
Can you follow up? So thank you for explaining that. I appreciate that. I'm wondering, just kind of musing over the implications of some group of individuals claiming that this is something that they are entitled to wear, which symbolizes something else, and they know it symbolizes something else. And so I reflect on something many, many years ago where schools were saying you can't wear certain color hats because it represented gang symbols and such. So I'm just kind of wondering if what protects this from staying in the concept of what it's intended to be regarding hair rather than extending out to someone that wants to wear a symbol.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. There is, and I'm not sure if it's included in your packet, but there is a really great letter from one of our invited testifiers, and I can provide it to the committee afterwards regarding the head wraps as gang affiliations question that came up in another committee. There is not evidence, to my knowledge, that there is gangs in our high schools that are using head wraps to identify. And a student is going to be part of a gang whether or not they're wearing a certain thing on their head. That's not really relevant to their gang affiliation. It does nothing to stop gangs or gang activity.
Are there any additional questions for Senator Wilson? All right. Thank you very much for this presentation today for introducing Senate Bill 174. The amendment deadline for this bill, along with all of the other bills that are being considered today, is Thursday, April 14th at 3 p.m. for the committee's information. And with that, thanks so much, and we'll see you again then on Friday, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. All right. Brief Eddies. All right. And we are back on the record. And I believe that we have online now Representative Fields joined us at 3:27 p.m. For the record. Welcome. It's good to see you, Representative Fields. And next up, we're going to go over to House Bill 176. And we have a committee substitute on the bill. And actually, Brief Eddies. All right. Sorry about that, folks. Now we're back on the record. Can I have a motion to bring to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 176?
Yes, I move committee adopt the CS for HB 176 LNC version B as the working document.
All right. Is there any objection for adopting this as the working document for the purposes of the committee?
I will object for the purposes of discussion.
All right. Super. And with that, we're going to have Chelsea Board Waller walk us through the committee substitute. It's fairly substantive, and I just want to put this sort of out on the record. The intention in adopting the committee substitute today was to get sort of a new version out on the record that everybody would be able to review in depth. It was in response to recommendations from Director Lori Wing-Heyer in an earlier committee meeting that we had, where she described the need to make sure that we were including some consumer protections in the legislation. There will be ample time to consider amendments. And as I mentioned earlier, as with all of the legislation that we're considering today, the amendment deadline is Thursday at 3 p.m. So you'll still have the opportunity to amend it. But we want everybody amending the same document and all kind of singing from the same sheet of music. And with that, Ms. Wardwalla, can you walk us through the changes?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Chelsea Wardwaller, staff to Representative Sponholz. I will walk through the summary of changes document version A to version B for committee substitute for HB 176. So section 1, page 1, line 7 and 8, we removed or the representative of the patient, and conforming changes were made throughout the bill to reflect this. Page 1, line 9, periodic was replaced with annual, and again, conforming changes were made throughout the document. A new subsection was added. Page 1, line 10, new language was inserted requiring the annual fees must be comparable for comparable services and may not be based solely on the patient's health status or sex. Page 1, line 14, adds a new subsection C and reorders the following subsections accordingly. Page 2, line 1, adds language to clarify the entities that are involved in direct healthcare agreements. Page 2, lines 9 to 11, removes language in subsection 4 and replaces it with additional requirements for the direct healthcare agreement as follows: that they must be printed in a font not smaller than 12 point and written using plain language that someone without medical training can understand. They must identify and include contact information for the person responsible for receiving and addressing a complaint made by a patient. And they must state the annual fee under the agreement for services must be comparable to other patients under the provider's other direct healthcare agreements and not based solely on the patient's health status or sex. Page 2, line 12, a new subsection is inserted, which allows a patient to terminate a healthcare agreement in writing within 30 days of entering the agreement. If that happens, the provider must refund to the patient payments made less. Patient payments made less for services already performed within 30 days. A nominal termination fee may be charged. Page 2, line 14, language is added, including a new subsection to state that a direct healthcare agreement may be terminated in writing after 30 days notice or in accordance with the agreement. Must provide for a refund and may provide for a nominal termination penalty or fee. Another new subsection is added to allow the parties in a direct healthcare agreement to modify or renew the agreement by written agreement. And the provider may not charge the annual fee under the agreement more than once a year and shall provide at least 45 days notice of a change in the annual fee. Page 2, lines 19 to 20, reverses language in version A to make direct healthcare agreements subject to AS 2107, patient protections under healthcare insurance policies, and AS 2136, trade practices and frauds. Page 3, line 2, inserts a new subsection that a person may not make, publish, or disseminate an assertion, representation, or statement regarding the business of direct healthcare agreements or with respect to a person related to direct healthcare agreement business if that is untrue, deceptive, or misleading. And another subsection which requires that healthcare providers in a direct healthcare agreement file report to the Division of Insurance no later than September 1st. That includes the number of healthcare providers in the practice, the number of direct healthcare patients, the practice has capacity to serve, the number of government entities, patients, and employers of patients that entered or maintained a direct healthcare agreement in the preceding calendar year, and the annual fee paid by each of those, and other information requested by the division. Page 3, line 3, inserts a new subsection defining a healthcare practice as a firm, corporation, association, institution, or other person licensed or otherwise authorized in this state to provide healthcare services. Page 3, line 30, inserts a new subsection which allows healthcare providers to decline entering into a direct care agreement with a new patient if that provider does not have the capacity. Page 4, line 2, references the definition for healthcare provider as previously referenced in AS 2103-025L. And page 4, line 4, inserts a new subsection 58 to add violating AS 2103-025 to direct healthcare agreements under the Unlawful Acts and Practices Statute of Article 3.
All right, thank you. And I just want to clarify, and we'll get an updated summary of changes. It looks like the summary of changes document, the lines and page numbers are a little bit off the actual committee substitute, and I was able to follow the draft, but the page numbers and line numbers were a little bit off. I just want to be clear with everybody, and we'll make sure that we get an updated summary of changes document to everybody so that's transparent for the public. The content is as was described by Ms. Wardwaller. Are there any questions, clarifying questions for Ms. Wardwaller? And then we'll go into the substance. Do you maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection.
All right. Is there any remaining objection to adopting the committee substitute? All right. Did you have
an objection? So when can we get the summary? Because I could not follow along with the current summary.
I think we can get that to you by 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. And I apologize. The content was correct. The line numbers and page numbers were off, and I apologize for that. It wasn't the intention to confuse the committee in any way. And just to clarify, as a reminder to everybody, we're not taking any official action besides adopting this as the working document for the committee. We're not moving it from committee. We're not changing anything. What this does is allows us to get on the public record so that we can start drafting amendments to this version of the bill. So just to clarify, no official action besides adopting this committee substitute as the working document for this committee. All right, do you maintain your objection?
No, I remove it.
All right, thank you. Do you have a question, Representative McCurdy? Kaufman? I apologize. I still have COVID brain. I'm working on it.
I just want to say thank you for those clarifications. I was starting to panic jumping around. I was able to find the content, and but things were just shifted. So I can say shift happens sometimes in documents. Thank
you. That's very appropriate. I had a similar experience as I was running through. I was like, something seems a little off here, and I realized that it was just that the page numbers and line numbers were a little bit off. It wasn't the intention on the part of the committee chairs to confuse anybody. It was unintentional oversight. All right. With that, the committee substitute for House Bill 176 has been adopted. Does anybody have any questions for Director Lori Wing Heyer while we've got her here today, in the event there's any questions for Representative Kaufman? Ms. Wing Heyer?
For the record, my name is Lori Wing Heyer, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the state.
Representative Kaufman.
Through the chair, to Ms. Wing Heyer. Well, thank you. Looks like a lot of work has been done here to try and tighten up some of the things that we saw. One of my concerns in the previous version was the kind of intractability of for the healthcare provider to shift somebody to another provider or to cease. And I lost track of where it was, though. I think it's page 3F. Let's see. So line 5, a direct health care agreement between a health care provider and a government entity, maybe that's not it. Can you direct me to the line item that is addressing what used to be requiring a healthcare provider to find somebody else another provider before they could bow out?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I am not positive that this version addresses that particular issue. This has put a lot of consumer protections in, but I'd have to go back and review it to see if that continuity of care that we discussed is actually in this version, sir.
Okay. Thank you. I'll take a look at it, too.
And I believe, Representative Kaufman, that in the work draft we're on page, the section you're referring to is page 5. It's under section 2, subsection B, lines 10 through 16.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. I'm excited that we're continuing to work on this bill. One thing that I do want to keep close attention on is our issue around primary care providers. I do understand and appreciate the value in reducing the patient panel size and therefore increasing the amount of time a provider. And I appreciate this isn't just about direct primary care, but that's something I'm focused on in particular, the increased time that a provider can spend with each individual patient. But the potential downside is that then we effectively have fewer primary care providers per our population as a whole if their patient panel is being reduced. And we typically see between half to a third patient panels from what I'm reading with direct primary care agreements. Can you help me understand, if you happen to know, how many primary care providers do we have in the state right now? And do you have a sense of current patient panel size or range here in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, I would have to go back and pull the number of primary care facilities or providers in Alaska, and I can see what I can do for you before the next committee meeting. As for the panel, are you talking how many patients would a doctor take under one of these agreements? It would be subject to what the doctor wanted, but I think that what we've heard in prior testimony was somewhere around 600.
Yeah. A follow-up. Forgive me. Yes, I do recollect the typical target panel size, and in readings it'll say anywhere between 400 and 1,000, depending. But I would be also curious what a current patient panel size is now under our more standard, typical model of care, just for comparison as we move forward.
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, I will make a couple calls. Primary Care Associates or another organization may have a better answer than we would at the division, and perhaps Hess has something. But I will see what I can find out for the committee.
Thank you.
All right. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, the presentation last time that the individual, primary individual who was sharing, he was from Florida and stated that this is their only model that they do. And so if they have referrals for more intense treatment that's needed, they just refer out. Concern I have is that we don't have as many physicians in Alaska as Florida does and some other places. And so what kind of concerns would you have if providers did both this type of agreement as well as were a PPO with insurance companies? And then the concern of, like, if they're charging for this as a CPT code with the as a PPO, but they do the exact same services under the direct agreement, which is just kind of lumped in, how's that play out?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty. So what you're asking is if they were basically double billing, they because they're going to get the fee under this contract, and then they turn around and bill the insurance company, correct?
Maybe not double dipping, but maybe they're choosing which is going to pay them the most.
Through the chair, I think that we're going to have to look at the contracts and see what the, I mean, that's what this is going to come down to. Does the contract provide for what services? Because the doctor or the provider will be able to determine what services they're going to offer. And I would hope that those that they think they cannot offer under this agreement, let's say they're charging $100 a month, and someone wants a test for some reason, an MRI, something that is going to cost more than the annual fee, then that should be outside of the direct care agreement because it won't work. I mean, they can only provide so much under these and the doctor not go under, or the facility not go underwater. And that is one thing we hope to watch. I think I'm going to give providers the benefit of a doubt that they know how to price for the flus, the, you know, I've got a sore throat. I've got, you know, this type of thing that I can get into the doctor quickly. I need an annual once or twice a year. You know, whatever it is, that that's what will be covered in this. But anything of real extensive cost for one, or that's going to take a specialist, I think they're going to have to refer them out and or charge the insurance company for those.
And I think the question that you raise is a really interesting one. You know, we want to make sure that from a consumer protection standpoint, that we're not in a situation where folks are sort of cherry picking and gaming the system. And I think that that's the kind of thing that that this committee needs to be considering. And it's one of the reasons that we wanted to make sure that we were addressing consumer protection in a pretty robust way. And this may be an area where we need to explore a little bit more to make sure that, you know, we're making sure that consumers don't get hurt along the way. All right. Do you have an additional question?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So with that, and I understand maybe some intent as I see providers, me being one, chasing after the money. The client's got the services, and yet the providers spend a lot of money in billing and trying to get it, and sometimes writing off a tremendous amount of, you know, because you can't go after the person, or
right.
It's not good to do that, but yet it happens. So I can see at least the providers are getting money up front through this format, and they're saying, I'm going to be responsible to following that format according to the contract, which we'll be taking a look at in that format there. But again, the concern of, we've seen this with labs where physicians will own a lab and refer a lot to their labs, and that's where they're making money, and they may be doing unnecessary referrals to labs, or concern of referring to a procedure that they also do, but they get paid on the other end over here in doing that. And I'm going to use this term, a bait and switch type of operation.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I mean, those are the things I think that any state would have to watch for. I think on the other hand, though, if you were able to attend or to watch Senator Wilson's Lunch and Learn today, you could hear the providers talk about how hard it is to recruit and retain physicians and basically staff overall. And yet what we heard from the speakers last time were that doctors or providers prefer these types of agreements because they don't become so burnt out. And they're not doing, I mean, they're addressing their patients' concerns through the contract, but they're not trying to chase that, as you're talking about, you know, trying to make their money off of referring for labs or additional tests or what have you, that maybe it does go on in the fee-for-service world, which is part of our concern or our issue with the cost of healthcare is fee-for-service. The more you send somebody out, the more they can make. And it's an antiquated model, without a doubt. This is a new model that we've not tried here, but it's got some merit.
All right, follow
this, and I appreciate hearing that from you. And I'm not labeling that doctors and, you know, healthcare people are scoundrels, because I'm one of those scoundrels, if that's the case, you know. But, you know, having those provisions in the bill to be able to capture that, and I actually had one of the scoundrels in Alaska come up to me to try to get into their game of lab type things. I'm like, nope, I'm not going to be part of this. Fortunately, that person is no longer practicing in Alaska. But I just want to make sure that if they show up, we can easily spot them and take care of our patients and our Alaskans.
To the chair, totally agree, Representative McCarty. And I think that this is going to be trial and error. You know, the committee has put in for an annual report to come back to the division. And there's some facts or data coming in that perhaps we'll be able to track and see if there is a concern with the way these are being utilized.
Thank you.
And that is exactly the reason that we put in the annual report, in part, was to be able to get some recommendations and then some fairly prompt feedback from, you know, the division, so that we could be really clear on what's happening and understand what, if any, sort of retooling that we need to do to ensure that Alaskans are being protected and we're not actually growing our healthcare spend rather than, you know, just improving the experience of folks, I think, maybe on both ends of the healthcare relationship in the state of Alaska. Are there additional questions on the bill? And just, you know, as a reminder, we're talking with Lori Wong-Hires, the director of the Division of Insurance, and she's not a healthcare provider expert or any of those things, but she is an expert in insurance and in consumer protection in the state. So any additional questions? And anybody online?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair, Ms. Wing-Hire. I haven't seen any evidence that this would happen, but one thing that I want to make sure is unlikely to happen is that people would basically migrate from a health insurance plan to a direct primary care plan only because it's cheaper. Just checking that you haven't seen that happen in other states that have legalized or encouraged direct primary care.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I have not heard that or read anything about that. But again, it is something we will watch the first couple of years as these roll out, this is enacted.
All right, do you have a follow-up, Representative Fields?
No, I support greater primary care access and just want to make sure we're not unintentionally encouraging a migration away from health care just without realizing it, away from health insurance, that is.
Wonderful. All right. Representative Shragi, do you have any questions?
Not at this time, thank you.
All right, I guess we are done. Thanks so much for joining us today, appreciate that. I did actually fail to mention earlier, and I apologize, we do have also online Heather Carpenter, who's a healthcare policy advisor to the Department of Health and Social Services, in the event anybody has any questions there. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess with respect to my previous question on page 5, starting at line 10 through 18, just I guess the question is, do you have any awareness of other language that might not be so prohibitive from someone entering into the agreement? As this is presently phrased.
And is that a question for Ms. Carpenter? Or would you?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Carpenter, did you hear the question?
Yes, for the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS.
I will take a look at that through the chair, Rep. Kaufman. I will just say that when it comes to Medicaid in this bill, it is a little bit more complicated, and the stance of the department would be that it would be cleaner if Medicaid was exempted from direct healthcare agreements because of concerns over audit trails, as well as Medicaid is a payer of last resort, and we have to track down any third-party liability before Medicaid can be a payer. So in terms of, looking at agreements, it gets really complicated fast when you have a direct healthcare agreement in consideration for a Medicaid population.
Do you follow?
Yes, thank you. That's great. If we could, have a conversation offline about that, to just try and dig into that. My concern is just that we come up with something that works, and that there's nothing built into this that's an impediment on either side of the arrangement.
All right. Thank you very much, and thanks for your time today. We're going to go ahead and set aside HB 176 for the rest of the day. As I mentioned, we will take up amendments later. The amendment deadline for this bill is Thursday, April 14th at 3 p.m., as it is for the other bills that are on today's docket. Next up, we're going to go to House Bill 276, psychologists. This is a House Labor and Commerce Committee bill that's being carried by Representative Fields' office. And I want to go ahead. We've been working with stakeholders on drafting a committee substitute. As was mentioned earlier, we're not taking any formal action on this. Adopting this document just allows us to get the working draft into the public sphere and for alleged legal to draft amendments to it. I just want to be really clear about that. Can I have a motion to bring the committee substitute before the committee?
I move the committee adopt the CS for HB 276, Labor and Commerce Version I, as the working document.
And we'll have Ms. Kubitz walk us through the committee substitute before
I'll object.
You'll object for the purpose of discussion?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Kubitz, go ahead.
For the record, Grace Kubitz.
Your microphone, your audio's a little off, Ms. Kubitz. We can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you now.
Great. Okay. I'll just come closer. For the record, Grace Kubitz, staff, the representative Zach Fields. And the House Labor and Commerce Committee made changes to 26 as a result of the collaboration between sports psychology and psychological associates in the Alaska Psychological Association. I'm happy to go through these changes step by step, but I think it might be most helpful if Marva Rigondeaux and Dr. Aaron Johnson speak to the collaboration, as it's largely deletions of concept and minor changes. They met a series of times to work on together.
All right.
Happily go through.
Ms. Kubitz, we're going to take a brief at ease. All right, we are we're back on the record. We did have a suggestion that we might try, and Ms. Kubitz might try turning her video off and see if that makes a difference. I'm not sure if it's the microphone or it's the or it's bandwidth, but we'll just experiment a little bit there. And we're gonna move over to hearing from Marvo Rigondeaux. I apologize for butchering your last name. Who's the executive director of the Alaska Psychological Association, and Dr. Aaron Johnson, who's chair of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, who have been working together as the sort of two leading stakeholder, representing the two leading stakeholder groups on the draft CS that we're working on. And if you could sort of describe the process that you went through, and then we'll, in order to get here, and then we'll go back to Ms. Kubitz for a walkthrough of the committee substitute. Let's start with, go ahead, Mr. We're going in.
Dr. Johnson, would you like me to start?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you and good afternoon, everybody, to the committee chairs and to the committee. My name is Marvo Reginden, and again, the executive director for Alaska Psychological Association. So my committee working on this legislation met a few times to consider the issues that were at hand on several parts of the bill and had agreements to drop several sections. With that, we met with the state licensing board to also go over a particular section, section two, that discussed some relicensing, resequencing of hours, where there were some concerns of public trust that could be violated if certain data, we couldn't find certain data at the point. So working with the board, we agreed that it would be beneficial for both parties to put this part on pause and make sure that we did our due diligence to find the data that that they're looking for and make sure that everybody was comfortable with that.
All right.
And then the last part of it, so that was the major part of the bill that was dropped. We did drop the part-time licensing, knowing that the time to process the license would be the same whether it was part-time or full-time. There would not be a reduction of fees. So it was also found that being able to monitor the number of part-time hours would not be very possible. So that's part-time license was also agreed to be dropped. And there was a section 10 and 11 that described or included a tribal health organization under a description of what psychology is not, what is not included in psychology, plus the aspect of what a tribal health organization is. There wasn't enough agreement or reach out to the tribal health organization for us to get clear, concise agreement of whether they would be agreeable to that. And so we've also, like Alaska Psychological Association has also agreed to drop that provision in the bill. Dr. Johnson, is there anything you would like to also add to this?
I will just say through the chair that all board members went with Mr. Reginden on March 18th, and they all voted to approve the bill with edits. The current version appears to have all the edits included.
All right. Thank you very much for that explanation, Mr. Reginden and Dr. Johnson. And next, we're going to go back up to Ms. Kubitz, and we'll see if the audio is working a little bit better now to have her walk through the explanation of changes. And just as a reminder to everybody, we're not taking any formal action beyond just adopting this as the working draft. So we want to make sure that we get this adopted today so that we can get it out in the public sphere and amendments can get drafted to it. All right, Ms. Kubitz.
Absolutely. Is the audio any better?
Oh, so much better. We can hear you loud and clear now.
Great. For the record, Grace Kubitz, staff to Representative Zach Fields, and I'll walk through a summary of changes from version A to version I. So we eliminated what was Section 2, which amended AS 0886-130, subsection A, which made it so that the board shall issue a psychology license to a person who has completed at least 3,000 hours of supervised professional experience gained through practicum, internship, or postdoctoral experience approved by the board or organized through a combination of those. As a reminder, this was all deleted. It also deleted that the board shall issue a psychologist license to a person who has submitted an application on a form approved by the board that includes a brief written account of the person's education, qualifications, and work history, as well as a proof of the person's competence to practice psychology, and that was provided for in documents specified in AS 0886-130C. In Section 3, line 10, we deleted the words 3 and recommendation and added instead letters of reference as established by the board from professional sources in the field of behavioral health familiar with the applicant's clinical level work of the previous 5 years. In Section 4, we eliminated Section 4, which amended the statute by adding a new subsection that outlines the qualifications required for the board to issue a part-time psychological license. Section 5, we deleted initial part-time license and part-time license renewal from the list of fees the department shall set, as they were deleted in the rest of the bill. We deleted in Section 6, subsection C, line 9, without unreasonable delay. We deleted in Section 7, subsection A, line 9, or part-time to confirm with the rest of the bill. We deleted Section 8, which amended AS0886 by adding a new section that outlines the board's ability to issue a part-time psychological associate license and the requirements to obtain such a license. Additionally, we deleted for part-time from Section 9, subsection A, again, to confirm with the rest of the bill. We deleted Section 10, which amended AS0886-180 subsection B to add a contractor of a tribal organization who is licensed to practice psychology in another state to the list of psychologists who this section does not apply to. And lastly, we deleted Section 11, which added a new subsection that defines tribal organization.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Are there any questions or any is your Representative McCarty?
Hi, through the chair, Grace, you mentioned on page 2 of the changes, it says Section 7, subsection A, line 9. So I'm trying to...
Are you referencing on the working draft, Representative McCarty?
I'm looking at the A version. Are you referring... Grace, are you referring to the CS?
No, I'm referring to version A. For the record, Grace, keep it in version A. That should be Section 7, subsection A, line 9 should be where we deleted or part-time, describing a person's ability to apply for an inactive license, because we eliminated the part-time from the bill.
You need an IDs?
Yes.
All right, brief IDs. All right, and we are back on the record. I think Representative McCarty has something you want us to mention.
Thank you. So on the record, that this summary of changes, page 2, where it says delete or part-time from section 7, subsection A, and it says line 9, which confuses things. It's actually reflecting line 17 and line 23, where that's being deleted.
Absolutely, through the chair. This is Grace Cupitz again for the record. You are absolutely correct. Thank you, and we can get that fixed in the summary of changes and out to the committee.
This is a great example of the committee process team. All right. Are there any additional questions? All right. And with that, I'm sorry, Representative McCarty?
I just want to say I greatly appreciate the effort in making these changes, as I saw a lot of things that need to be changed, and I wasn't really interested in moving this with the way it was, but it looks a lot better the way it is now. I do have a question for the psychologist. And on page 1 of the CS, line 10, it talks about, it adds, and a code of ethics. And I'm, we'll go out on a limb, but I'm not far on that limb, that already in your profession, our profession, that there is a code of ethics that has existed. The question I have, and also I see this on page 2, line 5 and 6, where it makes reference to National Association of Psychology Boards. Is the code of ethics that's being considered here in the statutes in any type of reference to some national code of ethics?
Dr. Johnson.
Question through the chair. Again, this is Aaron Johnson, chair of the psychology board. The most widely used code of ethics is the American Psychological Association's code of ethics that is adopted in our regulations. This specifically outlines it in the statutes. The National Association of Psychology Board is a member organization. Currently, we are members of ASPPB, which oversees and supports boards in Canada and all United States.
So just a follow-up there that appreciate that, and certainly we want to have a code of ethics. One of the concerns I have is sometimes a national group of individuals creates a code of ethics that doesn't fit for Alaska. And I think of an association I was part of, and the state was using their code of ethics, and they changed their code of ethics to talk about, certainly you can't have any type of relationships with a patient, and that's appropriate there. But they also said, and any extended family members that exist, and extended family members. And I thought, wow, that eliminates a lot of Alaska, because we are a big family. And so that mental health provider, psychologist, maybe in a quote, remote area, may also find themselves in romantically infatuated with someone that is not their patient, but yet it's an extended family member of a patient that they may have. And that would be a lonely life for that psychologist.
Agreed. And through the chair, this gives us the leeway to change the code of ethics to which we would adhere. At this point, we believe that APA is appropriate for Alaska and does not put such a narrow focus on topics such as you listed beforehand. So to my knowledge, the state has always used the APA code of ethics, but again, we can change that in regulations should we need to.
All right. And next up, we've got Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Ms. Cubitz, I believe. I'm looking on page 2, line 22, wherein item 5 says, provides documents specified in C of this section. And so I'm just wondering, can you confirm that that's the correct reference?
And Representative Kaufman, if you look at Section 3, it is Section C. It's a little confusing the way it's drafted, but Section C is immediately following it under subsection C is under Section 3.
So, thank you. Follow up through the chair. I guess I'm just wondering if that's in C of Section 3 for clarity.
Yeah, it's a good question. Ms. Kubitz?
Yep. Grace Kubitz, for the record, through the chair. I think that's correct and a good clarification.
All right. Any additional questions? Great example of the committee process working its way through here. Representative Snyder, do you maintain your objection to adopting the CS?
I will remove my objection.
Is there any remaining objection to adopting version I as our working document?
For the record, I had objected.
Oh, I apologize, Representative Kaufman. Do you maintain your objection?
It was near simultaneous.
Okay.
Yours was slightly ahead of mine.
All right. All right. You, Representative Kaufman, do you have an objection?
I did, but I removed
it. All right. Both of the objections to adopting the working draft have been removed at this point in time. Is there any remaining objection to adopting version I as the working draft of the committee?
I am objectionless.
All right. There is no objection remaining in this room, which is great news for the day. All right. Is there anything additional that either Mr. Regenden or Dr. Johnson would like to add today on House Bill 276 now that we've officially adopted the working draft?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks. Thank you to members of the committee.
All right.
And I would like to ditto that as well.
All right. Thanks so much. And it looks like we're going to go ahead and open this bill, House Bill 276, up for public testimony. House Bill 276 is now open for public testimony. There's no one in the room to testify. Is there anybody online available to testify? There's nobody online to testify on House Bill 276. It was noticed, and we have heard from the Executive Director of the Alaska Psychological Association and the Chair of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Examiners. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony then. All right, we're going to, as I mentioned earlier, the amendment deadline for this bill and all of the other bills that we've heard today is Thursday, April 14th at 3 p.m. I think I've said that like three or four times today, but I'm just trying to be super crystal clear because we're doing a little messy work here today. But sometimes that's the way the committee process works, and it's important that that's clear to everybody. Thanks so much to everybody on the committee. That wraps up our business this afternoon. We're going to get done a little bit early, which is always a blessing. Our next committee meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, April 13th at 3:15 here in Barnes Room 124. We're going to have a first hearing on Senate Bill 151 and an informational hearing on Alaska Higher. Thanks again to our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Lydia Klein. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 4:15 p.m.